Friday, June 15th, 2018, and the time is 8:45 a.m. I now call this meeting of the Finance Commission to order pursuant to Chapter 551 of the Government Code. There is a quorum with 8 members present. Jay Shands, Philip Holt, and Bob Borchoff contacted me to indicate that they would not be able to attend today's meeting. As you all know, June is typically a month of conflict for people with vacations and schedules, and happens to be 3 people. All 3 have requested that their absence be excused in accordance with the Finance Code 11.103. The commission members will take a vote to either accept or deny this request. All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
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 Any opposed, say nay. The ayes have it and the absences are excused. Moving on to Finance Commission matters. On the consent agenda are the minutes of our last 2 meetings for the Finance Commission. With respect to public comment, we don't have any, right? Okay. If there is anyone willing to fill out, wishing to address the commission during our time of public comment, please fill out a witness card and bring it up front. In accordance with our policy on testimony, public comments are not allowed on agenda items related to final rule adoptions, except upon majority vote of the commission, in which comments are limited to 5 minutes. Members, before we take up the consent agenda, item 3, which is A1, C2, and C3 in a single vote, I want to state that any commission member may request that an agenda item be removed from the consent agenda and placed on the regular agenda so that it may be discussed and voted on individually. Hearing no objections from any members, do I hear a motion to adopt consent agenda items A1, C2, and C3 without discussion?
So moved.
So moved by Molly. Second? Is there a second?
Second.
Second? But, okay, Matt. Any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it and the motion passes. Moving on to agenda item 4, Finance Commission Operations. Charles?
Madam Chair, we really don't have anything specific to go over. I think each agency has some points when they get to their specific area. As you know, we've been going through the sunset process, which is kind of the next on the agenda, so that's taken up most of our time.
Okay. Moving on to agenda item 5, which is discussion of the review of sunset. A few comments there. So with respect to sunset, I think everybody's probably current on where we are at this point, but it's obviously been an agenda item ongoing for us since last August. At this stage of the process, the most recent event was the 3 agency heads and myself testified at the commission hearing, which was on May 24th. Each one of us had the opportunity to make an opening statement, which we did. And then we fielded a variety of questions from the different members on the Sunset Commission on issues. I'd like to thank the 3 agency heads for doing an outstanding job there. We had 7 members from the commission itself who attended, and I would like to personally thank all of them for showing up and supporting the commission and this process. For those who were unable to attend, should you have a burning desire to spend 4 hours watching our sunset testimony, you can by going on the website and looking at the link, and it is there and you can watch it. And you might find it very interesting. You can scroll through and watch pieces of it or the whole thing if you feel so motivated, but you would get an idea of exactly what occurred there. There were 27 witnesses who testified after the agency presentations. We really kind of focused our comments on the 2 most significant issues that we addressed, which were consolidation and the sweeping of penalty revenue, and there was no testimony that was opposed to our positions on either of those issues. We actually started at 9 and we finished at 12:55, right before the 1 p.m. deadline. So it was a lengthy morning. I think everybody that was there, of which I see a lot of faces in the room who were there, felt that a good job was done by all and that we presented ourselves in a very positive light. And I certainly appreciated the opportunity to be there and speak on behalf of the commission. And I'm very proud of the agencies and the job that we do every day in addition to how we presented ourselves that day. I really appreciate everything that the staff has done, those who were there, and what you've done to support, you know, your agency heads as they're working through the sunset process. I realize this is difficult. And it's difficult on the staff as well, especially staff in particular at Savings and Mortgage Lending who are going through, you know, a recommendation to be eliminated. So I'm sensitive to that, and I just really appreciate everybody's support during this. With respect to the stakeholders and the trade associations, I thank y'all for everything that you've done to get your voices heard. It's very important, and that's the opportunity you have to weigh in. And I appreciate your comments about the well-run regulatory agencies that you're licensed or regulated by, because they are well-run agencies. And then for the additional witnesses who kindly volunteered but did not get called to testify, thank you for being willing to do that. So the next step at this point is the decision hearing. We don't know yet what point of the schedule we'll be on, but those 2 days are August 28th and August 29th. And at one of those points, 29th and 30th. Thank you. How could I not remember those dates? They're ingrained in my brain at this point. And we don't know what day or time we're at yet. The decision will be announced there, but as you know from our prior timeline that we've gone through, nothing is actually final until we go through next year's legislative session. And with that, that's just a general overview of sunset status and process. Moving on to Audit Committee. Molly?
The Audit Committee would like to make a motion that the Finance Commission approve the Texas Department of Banking's audit report on the prepaid funeral guarantee funds as prepared by Garza Gonzalez and Associates.
Coming upon recommendation from the Audit Committee, no second is needed. Any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The ayes have it and the motion passes. Strategic Planning Report, Will?
As we discussed earlier, the Strategic Planning Committee has met and made a recommendation to approve the Commission's strategic plans for 2019-23. The process was explained by Commissioner Cooper. All very good plans, and no further comments. The Strategic Planning Committee would like to make a motion that the Finance Commission approve the agency's 2019-2023 strategic plans.
Coming upon recommendation from the Strategic Planning Committee, no second is needed. Any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it and the motion's adopted.
There was also a discussion regarding the 2019-2023 strategic plan for the Texas Finance Commission, which Charles also explained the process. And we'll be next reviewing that.
But we have no action we need to take at this point. Great.
Correct.
Okay, thank you very much. Well, thank you for chairing strategic planning, for getting the three agencies done, and I know you still have the Finance Commission left. Thank you to Bob and to Matt for participating. I know that our cycle, at least it seemed to me, to be much shorter than usual from the time we got instructions to the time these reports were due, and I know everybody had to jump to it and move quickly. We talked about budget process in the Audit Committee meeting, which is on page 23. And so, first, since everybody was here, I'm not going to revisit that, other than just to remind you that that's the next step that we have. The agencies are working on that. Of course, stakeholders weigh in on that process. They review and they approve the budgets as well, so that we can get to the point of the public meeting for full transparency in soliciting as much commentary and input as we can get with respect to our budgets. So appreciate everybody's reviewing those once they come out and any comments that you might have. And then the other thing that I wanted to comment on in particular was page 64 of our book, because I could not let this go without comment. And so for those of you who did not focus on this page, this is our webcast statistics viewership. And I just wanted to comment that, boy, we are really in a positive trend. We're up 800% in our viewership, which I think would imply that it is not no longer just family members, unless everybody's really solicited every family member to be watching. So I appreciate the chart. Friends. Thank you. Vincent, I don't have any family members you've enlisted.
Well, actually, my wife goes around to all the computers in the house.
Okay, but that should still be just three or four, I hope.
Yeah.
So I guess my perspective here is that we now have 53 more people more knowledgeable of what we do because of our webcast, and I appreciate that statistic. Agenda items 8, 9, and 10, we will move to executive session, and that takes me to agenda item B, Consumer Credit Commissioner Leslie.
Thank you. Our report begins on page 29. However, first I would kind of like to touch on a few items of economic interest. before, which is not in your materials, but I'll just, some recent statistics that I always find interesting and I wanted to share with you. Total consumer debt, according to the New York Federal Reserve quarterly report, grew by 3.8% from a year earlier. Overall, delinquency as a whole has declined slightly because of improvements in student loans and mortgages, but delinquency in credit cards and auto loans have continued to climb. Delinquent auto loans rose to 4.3% from 3.8% a year earlier. According to Moody's, there's an opinion that auto loan defaults should be a little bit lower given the strong employment market. According to Edmund, the volume of auto loan originations has slowed and the terms have become looser. The average length of a new loan rose to 69.2 months in April compared to 65.5 months in April of 13. So we see increasing trend. And then also some statistics that were cited by Melinda Zabriskie, the Senior Director for Experience Automotive Financial Solutions team. She's presented recently at a meeting for the National Association of Consumer Credit Administrators and for the American Financial Services Association Government Affairs Forum. Her report is now that more than one in four loans, auto loans, are greater than 73 months or greater, with some reaching 84 months. And in the fourth quarter of 2017, the average car loan was at $31,000 with an average loan rate of 5.1%. So there seems to be a growing affordability issue in the auto market. Average per capita income in the U.S. is also $31,000, the same figure as the average new car loan. Past 10 years, the average new car loan amount has risen from $24,000 to today's $31,000. Hmm. So anyway, just some affordability issues and some trends we're kind of looking at, watching to see what's going to happen in the auto market. But I just thought those were so
interesting.
I wanted to share that with you. All right, moving on to the report on page 29. You see our standard report for the examination activity and the 2,534 examinations that were completed through April and how those are dispersed across the particular industry segments. We're in pretty good shape. Our expectation is to meet our examination fiscal year goal and pretty much within each strata of the industries. We are working on hiring a new class of financial examiners. We've got a few growing vacancies, so we'll have a fairly large class. We're getting ready to start. We hope to have those in place before the end of the fiscal year. I know this report says they may be assigned to Dallas and San Antonio regions, but that may be growing with some new information that's happened since this report was produced. On page 30, our statistics on acceptable level of compliance. Those are all in really pretty good shape. I was really noting on the bottom of page 30, that chart there, if you look at the last four quarters for acceptable level of compliance, and this is the trailing 12-month figure, so it's really representative of a whole 12 months of time, it's a lot of stability I think we're beginning to see in some of our acceptable levels of compliance, which I'm hopeful that we'll kind of maintain that pattern. But I was pleased to see the sort of stability we were beginning to see. I know we're going to hit some swings in one particular area, I expect, in the fourth quarter. On acceptable level compliance, so we are going to see some dip in one industry segment, but we'll stay tuned for that information. Still being developed, but it's not looking good. On page 31, investigations completed. Our activity this year is down by about 36% from the same period in the prior year. We had a lot of heightened activity in the prior year that happened a bit early. We still expect to meet our annual targets for this year, but we may be a bit below where the prior level activity is, but still within the targets. Bottom of page 31, the complaints processed. Those are down about 15%. We've had some issues with turnover and some training of quite a few new folks in that area. We're seeing a greater complexity of complaints coming across recently, and that's beginning to have some impact on extending processing times. But nonetheless, I think we're still within, you know, a good posture on handling those customer complaints. And then on page 33, we've been reporting this ratio of complaints processed to the total population of the particular industry segment, and those rankings are fairly consistent. It's a fairly consistent trend since the beginning of the fiscal year. It is a little bit different ranking, as we've talked previously, because of the impact of Hurricane Harvey, with pawn shops being higher than we've historically seen them. But with the exception of two groups that flipped, this trend has been fairly consistent throughout the fiscal year thus far. So it's just, again, interesting observations. On page 34 is some updated information, data on the credit access businesses and the reports that we run. And, you know, you're looking at a full 6 years of history year over year in some aspects here. We see the number of locations with activity increasing slightly over the Q1 period, which is a new trend. It seems like the consolidation has appeared to stabilize a little bit, although recent events may be impacting that going forward, but for now it seemed like things were kind of beginning to stabilize a bit in that area.
I have a question.
Sure.
Excuse me. That probably already asked in prior meetings, but take, for example, in the middle section, payday loans Q1, the next to last category, average fee per $100 borrowed.
Yes.
Does that amount does not include interest, is that correct? Or does that include interest?
It does not include interest. However, the interest is a simple annual rate of 10% or less. So the interest amount is very small comparatively. I mean, pennies.
So essentially they're paying, like in 2018, 24% for fees of what they borrow.
If you borrow $100, you're paying $24 on it to pay it back in 22 days or
and
14
then so,
days.
So why would the fees go up to $145 per $100 for multiples?
So the calculation on multiples is a bit more convoluted to get to the outlook, but it's paid over a period of time. And so this is a fee not for a month, it's a fee over the period of time.
So that, okay, I guess the way I think of fees is fees are one time, interest is based on length of time,
yeah.
But you're saying in this world that they're able to charge fees every month or every period?
It depends on the transaction, but in some cases, yes, they are.
Is there any regulation of that?
The statute does not limit that. In fact, the statute authorizes that fees can be collected in any frequency, more or less.
Is anyone concerned about that?
There are certainly, I've heard people express concern about that, yes.
Yeah.
But
okay, thank you.
Okay. Page 35 is our licensing report. We are currently in the renewal cycles for pawn shops. That's coming to a close, but that's going fine. And then motor vehicle renewals will be opening soon. That will happen mostly through the month of July. We're seeing our business license application processing volumes kind of ticked up a little bit. Our applications received are running about 7 to 8% greater than we projected, but we continue to work on processing through those. That kind of slows down a little bit when we're in the middle of renewals, but we'll pick that back up pretty quickly. In other updates, we've been reporting to you about the fact that we were bringing crafted precious metal dealer registrations onto our online portal system, Alex. Implementation of that has occurred. The functionality is now present, although it's currently shielded from public view until we have the official cutover from DPS, which is coming soon this summer. But that's been completed and we think is ready to go. So that's good news. On page 36 is our licensing and registration dashboard. Really, those are typical trends. I'm not seeing anything that's really concerning. You'll see the total of all regulated entities at the is 36,288 on the lower right-hand chart. And otherwise, that all is the data as of May 1st, but otherwise that data.
Leslie, what's the significance of the big drop in
the debt management service providers?
I just went through a renewal, and we see the drop-offs, and because they're smaller numbers, the percentage looks pretty steep, but there's a lot of folks that thought they wanted to be debt management service providers and then didn't renew, so they just they expired and canceled. I don't know that there's anything specific. We see little cycles in that particular area. People get in the business but then don't continue.
And on those, do you think they were active people who left the business or just people who were licensed and maybe just never functioned in that space?
I think probably the latter. There's some that have gotten licensed. There's some that, and a lot of these are from out-of-state providers too that are trying to reach Texas residents. But I could try to get more information. I don't really have anything more than that, but we can try to do a little more analysis of this.
It just sort of stuck out.
Yeah, it does, jumps out.
Wondered if it was indicative of improving credit, so.
Leslie, in layperson's term, what is that?
Wishful thinking.
These are the folks, well, there's two activities that happen under debt management service providers. One is like what you would think of as a debt consolidation, like with consumer credit counseling or something like that, where a company will take the monthly payments to pay the creditors, and they'll work to get concessions, perhaps. And then the other is what we call debt settlement providers, and those folks will have, usually consumers will set up some type of account and divert X number of dollars every month to the account until there's a sufficient amount to negotiate with a creditor to pay off and settle a debt for some amount less than the total debt. So those are the two activities that happen in that area.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, on page 37 is the communication report, and I think one thing I wanted to mention towards the bottom, I know we talk about a number of presentations and communications that we're participating in with a bunch of our regulated segments of our regulated industry. Summer is a pretty active season for our trade industry and their trade groups. A lot of them hold their annual conventions in the summer, or lots of meetings, and so during the season we're typically invited to present at a number of those, so we'll be pretty active this summer working with a number of our groups, and we appreciate those opportunities. We appreciate being invited to speak and think that it works well for us to be able to share compliance information with those different groups of the regulated industries. But I mean, we can approach turnover issues later at the next meeting, but turnover's begun to increase as the labor market's gotten a little bit tighter. I think we're certainly seeing that. While it says we only had one vacant position, we only had one vacant position posted currently, but that's about to change with some of the examiner class and some other groups that we're working with. The financial literacy and education, there's the report, but it's with information on where we are on our progress goals to date, but we're well on track to meet all of our goals, and that's going well. And I think there's a link to, in the electronic version, there's a link to a new brochure that we kind of helped put together for a group that we were trying to reach that was in need of some additional resources on financial education. Then I wanted to call your attention to a page that's marked as 40A and 40B. We discovered that we had inadvertently omitted this page from the last meeting material. This is the executive summary chart and the performance measures. And so we want to be sure that those are properly submitted to you. So we apologize for the omission. We prepared them, it just got missed in the materials. But you're gonna get the third quarter reports in August, which will have, of course, that information as well. But we just certainly, for the interest of full completeness, want to be sure that was in there. And then I'll be happy to answer any questions. Otherwise, I call on Michael to do the legal report.
I do have one question before we do that. Back on page 33.
Yes.
So on the pawn shop ratio of complaints, and I know some of those are Harvey related, especially those that are the replacement of lost and damaged goods.
Correct.
What is a pawn shop's obligation with a lost or damaged good, and what happens in that case?
So the obligation is to replace it with like-kind merchandise. And so it depends on what has happened with the item, but if it's lost or damaged, the pawn shop goes through steps to try to present something that's a like-kind replacement. And if the customer agrees, then they agree and there's no problem. If the customer disagrees, we'll often have to get involved and try to help determine whether the proposed item that's offered is indeed like-kind or not.
So does the pawn shop have an insurance coverage that assists
often,
them with that?
Often
okay.
They will have some kind of coverage.
Okay.
And they take a lot of steps to try to protect. I mean, they know the liability associated with those pawned items, and so they'll take steps. And in fact, I mean, we see some of the actions that folks have begun to take in regards to preparation for natural disasters and things, that they'll even physically move some of that merchandise out of the location if there's a hurricane coming and they can protect it better by moving it to another location or something. They'll take steps to try to ensure to protect themselves and protect the customer's merchandise as best they can.
Okay, thank you.
Michael Rigby, General Counsel for the Office of Consumer Credit Commissioner. The legal report begins on page 41 of your materials. Wanted to update you on a few things and discuss one observation. On the first page, page 41, there's our summary of the Credit Access Business quarterly and annual reports. This is where the statute requires that CABs file these reports on a quarterly and annual basis. If they're filed late or incomplete, then we issue an injunctive order requiring them to comply with the law. We've seen a trend towards greater compliance. In 2016, we issued 26 enforcement actions, in 17, 21, and this year there was only 5 for that same period. So I think that's a reflection of both our approach to doing injunctions. Also, we've been working with our staff to work with the industry to afford them extra time to make sure that they get the reports in, and it's reflection of the industry itself, which I think is stepping up to file these reports on time, and they're getting greater understanding of what's required. On page 43, there's a summary of litigation. That first case, State of Texas versus Cash Auto Sales and VIP Finance, I have an update to the third paragraph. The end of the third paragraph says that the state's appellate brief is due on June 7th. The AG has requested an extension to June 22nd, so that's a new piece of information. And then on page 46.
Michael, can we go back to 44?
Sure.
Under the Henry versus Cash Biz, I'm a little confused, and perhaps you could help me. Tell you what I think I understand.
Okay.
What I thought I understood was that it was not permissible to file criminal charges against folks for borrowing money and did not repay. But this looks like that rather than being a borrowing matter, it is an attempt to repay with a bad check. Is that right or wrong, or what am I missing here? Or maybe just tell me what the law is.
Sure, I think you're correct that a cab cannot use the criminal justice system to collect a debt, private civil debt. And that there is a part of Chapter 393 which requires the cab to include that disclosure to the consumers that they can't do that, and they shouldn't be doing that. The decision in Henry versus Cash Biz had to do with an arbitration provision, and so there is some language in there that talks about how this particular business presented those charges to the local law enforcement, to the JP court. So I think there is some language in there that we've looked at, we're concerned about, but our position remains the same, that cab should not be using the criminal justice system to collect
debts. So did this cab use the criminal justice system wrongfully?
That was not before the court.
No, I'm asking you.
We took action against them.
Have you ever seen an attorney give an opinion?
The question I'm asking is, and maybe you've answered it, Wesley, if a cab uses the criminal justice system wrongfully, mm-hmm. that seems like it ought to be a violation of its license in some fashion and require some action on behalf of the OCCC.
Yes, we took action against them, and we would take action against any other cab who did the same thing.
What action did we take?
I think it was an agreed order. Mm-hmm. It's been a year and a half or so since that happened.
There was some kind of agreed order. They paid some restitution to some mm-hmm. of the consumers involved and paid a penalty, I think, as well. Where's Matt? He probably remembers it.
Because to me, it's just sort of outrageous behavior to attempt to use the criminal justice system to try to collect the debt.
We agree.
Yeah. Oh yeah, we're with you.
Thank you. Moving on to page 46, the top of that page.
I will say that if they write hot checks to try to pay, that's a different issue.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. There is a distinction between intentionally writing a hot check and engaging in a deferred presentment transaction in which you provide the cab with a check, which you probably don't have funds in that
right.
to cover, but with the understanding that it'll be cashed at a later date.
Right.
And if there's no further questions, page 46 is the CFPB payday loan rule. There's some updates in that case. This is a case that's filed here in Texas, but in federal court, it was brought by the Community Financial Services Association of America and Consumer Services Alliance of Texas. It was filed against the CFPB to invalidate the payday loan rule, but the both the plaintiffs and the defendant, the CFPB, filed a joint motion to stay the proceedings and to delay the compliance date of the rule. The judge in that case issued kind of a split decision. He agreed and granted the stay of the lawsuit itself, but denied the motion with respect to delaying the compliance date. The judge also granted a motion by some consumer groups to be granted leave to file some amicus briefs. So kind of a variety of opinions from the judge in that case. We'll see what happens. And if you'd be glad to answer any questions, but if there is none, that's all I have.
Thank you, Michael. Okay, that concludes our report for the Office of Consumer Credit Commissioner.
Okay, thank you.
We have no rules.
Just the upcoming rules that are...
Right, rule review
last,
that are scheduled
yeah,
out.
Review.
But,
yeah. Okay, thank you.
Great. The report for the Texas Department of Banking is on page 51, but before I go into that, I would like to make three introductions of some fairly recent promotions at our senior level. We have these three people here. Number one would be Ruth Norris. Ruth, would you stand, please? Ruth was promoted to Chief IT Security, the Chief of the IT Security Examination Sector. Ruth is from Houston and has been with the department for 12 years. Congratulations.
Congratulations.
And then we have Michelle Hodge. Michelle, please stand. Michelle is promoted to review examiner. It's here in headquarters. Michelle is previously from Houston, and she's been with the department 15 years. And last but not least, Travis Graham. Travis promoted to review examiner here at headquarters, and Travis has been with the department for 10 years. Congratulations. So then, starting on page 51, so as of 228, it shows that we had 238 banks. Okay, 238, so we always talk about that. And down at the bottom, again, as of 228, we had 12 of those that were rated 3, 4, 5. And as you can tell, we kind of bounced around at that number. And most of them will be in the 3 category, which is the least problematic. Then on page 52, again, the enforcement actions, as of 228, they're showing a very slow trend downward as your number of problem banks go down, that theoretically go down with it. The bottom of the page, we are within our examination priority goals. On page 53, I would like to point out, and you probably read a little bit about it, that May the 24th, the president signed legislation. It's the first time that the Dodd-Frank bill has been reduced to some degree. So this bill has been going on. It's called Senate Bill 2155. It was passed out of the Senate, went to the House. It stayed in the House for a while because the House had like 30 related bills that they wanted to include. The Senate basically said, no, we're not going to do anything else. And so the House finally accepted the bill. I've got some bullet points about what it does. I will say that the bill helps community. It's really a little bit of in there for everyone. It helps community banks to a degree. And let me give you the first one, the capital simplification. So it basically says if you're under $10 billion and you're a community bank, if you have a capital leverage ratio, a simple leverage ratio between 8 and 10% to be determined, that you're exempt from several things. Now, our bank's average capital ratio is over 10%, so that's really not that big of a deal for our banks. But the big deal is that if you have this and you elect to go into this, you are exempt from some of the other federal regulations. So the thing that I would also like to point out in the bold, when Chairman Crapo came out with the bill, it was a bipartisan bill, and he presented it to the committee, and he basically said there will be no additions to that bill. Well, you see the part down there in bold, it says the federal banking agency shall consult with the applicable state bank supervisors in carrying out this section. We were able to get Chairman Crapo to add what they call a manager's amendment to require that the federal agencies had to consult with the state banking departments, number one, in determining what banks are in or out of this ratio, and number two, to determine what the ratio is. There's not a lot to determine between 8 and 10%, but it'll be an interesting concept. But they have to consult with us. That's probably one of the first times that I can recall where in legislation they actually have to consult with us. Our federal counterparts really didn't like that very much because they don't like having to consult with us. But it is required. I think Chairman Crapo is aware that 78% of all banks are state chartered in the country. That number is rounded up now to 79%, so it's actually growing. So I thought that was a major achievement by the state banking departments. Several other items in there, the exam cycle goes to an 18-month exam cycle. Right now, our exam cycle is every 12 months, a bank under a billion is on an 18-month cycle unless there's something unusual on it. Now that cycle goes up to $3 billion. So it increases from $1 billion to $3 billion. And we have about 10 banks between $1 and $3 billion. So it does impact scheduling and things like that. And we are prepared to implement that. Our federal counterparts have to come up with a rule. So there's a lot of good things in there. I won't say it's not the panacea. Community banks need a lot more relief, but it's a step in the right direction.
Commissioner Cooper?
Yes.
How many banks of the 238 banks, how many of them are over 10 billion?
Over 10? Three.
Three.
We'll say it is commendable to actually have percentages put up there, 8 to 10%. Actually being spelled out finally, you know. But all I'm seeing is 8, Charles. Is that what everybody's going to say?
Well, you know, again, it'll be interesting to see. I don't think it'll be 8.
I think it'll fall on 10.
I think it'll be somewhere between 9 and 10. But it'll be an interesting process. So at the bottom of the page, I just want to point out that we're going through a CSBS accreditation process. We've been accredited, our banking department has been accredited by CSBS since 1993. You go through that every 5 years. We're going through it now. They will be on site. It's just another audit, another review that we have to go through. A team of primarily former regulators come in and do the review. They're scheduled to be here in October. But it's a very, very important process. I believe, I can't, at the last time, we're not supposed to say this, I have to say it right. At the last time, if we didn't get the highest score, we got close to the highest score ever achieved. So we hope to do as well this time. Then on page 54, just some activities that we participated in, just for your information. Then on page 55, the applications from Dan Frazier, Director of Corporate Activities. I would like to point, again, 56 talks about conversion activities and related activities. We had one of our banks merged into another one of our banks. So when you get into the number game, that means we go from, it went 2-1. I will say that since this report was issued, we had a national bank convert to state charter, and we have a couple of those conversions in discussion stage now. So we still see activity in banks wanting to get into the state system. Page 57, the special activities, special audits report. Nothing really new in there. I will point out at kind of the middle of the page on the entities, you'll see a new one called Bullion Depository Agent. We do not have any now. The precious metal Bullion Depository is opened. I understand it's open for business right now. We regulate, and they have to register with us, the agents, and we don't have anybody registered at this time. The rest of that in there is normal activities. On page 58, I won't say abnormal activity, but it goes into some of our investigations. We have investigations going on now with the Department of Homeland Security in the Laredo area. We also have investigations with Homeland Security and the Department of Justice in Dallas. So we are, again, very active in that, and that goes to the fact that we spend a lot of time and resources on these investigations where we probably will not receive any fines or penalties, but hopefully we're in there to just do the right thing. Our prepaid funeral guarantee fund advisory council met here in this room.
In terms of those division activities, does that come from the feds as well, or is that, are we working with the federal counterparts on that?
Yes.
Yeah, we wouldn't have any, we wouldn't assess
it. What we did part. Was, when we, in one of our investigations, we found that it was probably violating federal statutes. We worked with them, and we're basically going to turn over our information.
That's basically our role, just to share it with the federal, since we don't have any oversight.
In that case, yes. Then, beginning on 59, goes to our strategic support activity. Talks about complaints, the pie chart. In my opinion, everything in there is basically kind of as we've seen before. Just as time goes by, we just have more of those. And then on page 63, the activities, I wanted to point out that the Financial Fitness Greater Austin Smart Kid Assay Contest presented by Capital One was conducted here, and Wendy Rodriguez was one of the judges on the assay contest. It was done on June 2nd. And then down at the bottom of the page, website, Finance Commission website is undergoing redesign and is in its final stages. Wendy, how close are we?
August, we're in the middle of getting feedback, and then we're going to present it up to the
then is on page 64, as Chair London pointed out, that's our webcast statistics, and we'll put those in there as long as y'all would like to see them. Any questions on what I presented so far? So far, the legal update, I'd like to ask Captain Breyer, General Counsel, to come forward, please.
Good morning, members. The legal division report begins on page 65, and I just have a couple of issues I wanted to mention to you. These both have to do with pending contested cases. In my time here, we've had very, very few contested cases, but right now we're seeing a little wave. The first one of these, we actually went to a hearing. I mentioned this briefly to you at the last meeting because I think the hearing had happened the day before the Finance Commission meeting, so I didn't make it into the packet. But now you have a little summary. This is an entity called Bellwood Memorial Park. We've done repeated examinations of them, and we've found multiple instances where they failed to timely deposit perpetual care funds as required by the statute. So we recommended a $35,000 administrative penalty. The respondent did not appear at the hearing. The ALJ issued his proposal for decision, granting the department's recommendation for the $35,000 penalty. The respondent did not file any exceptions, but we're awaiting still the final proposal from the judge, and then we expect the commissioner to issue an order later this summer. The second matter there is regarding JetPay Corporation and JetPay HR and Payroll Services. This is an entity that we've determined to be engaging in unlicensed money transmission activity. So we've set a hearing for June 28th. We issued a cease and desist, and we are recommending that a penalty be assessed against this entity. So we're gonna have a hearing hopefully at the end of this month, unless something changes. But at this point, we are expecting to go to hearing, and I will let you know at the next meeting how that turns out.
Catherine, in the first case, so failed to timely deposit funds.
Right.
So was that the checks were held? Was it that they're in the wrong account versus where they're supposed to be?
There's a certain time period in statute within which they have to deposit, and when we do our exams, we look to see when those deposits were made, and there were just repeated instances of days late, weeks late, months late. It wasn't a one-off situation. This is a frequent flyer, unfortunately, with us, that we've actually gone to hearing against them previously. We've had orders issued against them previously, and it just, unfortunately, the activity just continues.
Well, and I figured that probably was the case with the $35,000 penalty being the full amount recommended, so
right.
I figured you were trying to make a statement.
Right.
And what do you think the likelihood of collecting the penalty might be?
That's a sort of anybody's guess. You know, it's a catch-22 for us because a lot of these entities are small and
yeah.
they don't have a lot
of money.
Which
was going to be my next question.
Yeah.
How large
yeah.
are they, and is that something they would even?
We absolutely considered the size. It is not our intention to put anybody out of business.
Yeah.
We want them to be compliant, and we want to encourage compliance. So we had a very careful discussion with our special audits folks to make sure that what is fair here, based on their size, based on the pattern, based on the seriousness of the violations, and we felt like $35,000 was an appropriate number. I think the way we ended up calculating the number that we made our recommendation on was it was 35 months of
non-compliance.
Yeah, non-compliance and $1,000 per month. But absolutely, we did take into consideration their size, and it is not an easy situation for anyone. It's just it's a tough, tough situation.
So in the case of something like this where there's basically a pattern of practice
mm-hmm.
of non-compliance, is that something where you'll go back in more frequently and look at them on a shorter cycle? Or
yeah,
yeah.
We can go back every 6 months.
Okay.
And for him, strangely enough, he's paid every single penalty. He'll pay the penalty and get better, and then he forgets. And then he pays the penalty and gets better.
That makes sense.
I mean, all the other penalties he has paid.
Okay.
Let's keep charging.
What's the nature of this entity? Is it a corporation?
It's a, they actually hold both a certificate of authority for Perpetual Care Cemetery and also the permit to sell prepaid funeral contracts. It's, I believe it's just a, it's a corporation, closely held, you know, corporation. You know, and they've been in business for a long time.
It's just another sort of loans.
He's another bookkeeper.
It's, yeah, it's just, it's really unfortunate.
Any other questions?
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. And the items on page 67 and 73 were on the consent calendar.
Okay. Thank you. Moving on, we'll go to savings and mortgage lending.
Okay. Savings and mortgage lending begins on page 79. I'm going to start with the thrift industry, and I'll give you a general overview of what the state savings banks currently. The status of the thrift industry as a whole remains basically the same as at your last meeting. 92% of the savings banks are well rated. Non-performing assets are low at 0.49%. Assets continue to grow primarily organically, but also through acquisitions. We still have two formal enforcement actions, and two of the department's areas of potential focus remain long-term asset exposure and liquidity. I'll talk a little bit more about each of those in a moment. There's been no industry-wide increase in concern, and through off-site monitoring and the on-site examinations, we're aware of who the outliers are and what they can do if they need to.
Carolyn,
can
you go back to chart A?
Yes.
Where you have a very nice upward trend in aggregate industry assets.
Correct.
What do you attribute that to?
They are, it's primarily organic, so they are primarily through deposit gathering, deploying funds to make loans, and then additionally, some of them are acquiring other institutions and other branches. Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Yes. Wednesday, you all may know, but Wednesday the Federal Reserve increased interest rates 25 basis points. This was the second increase this year, and it's forecasted that there may be two more this calendar year. So that is something, because of the long-term assets of our thrifts, that's something that we'll continue to monitor and report to you all as we see, particularly if we see any impact on the industry. I do want to spend a few minutes on the two areas I mentioned. First, page 80, the chart C is long-term asset exposure. Because each of those savings banks has at least 50% of their assets in residential mortgage lending, we always focus on long-term asset exposure. You all have heard me talk about it many times. Market risk has been elevated since about March 2017. That's due to a small number of institutions that's causing that elevation, and we are monitoring them closely for how they identify and mitigate their risk and for any directive action that we need to give them to do so. The second area of focus is on page 81. It is chart D, and that's liquidity risk. The median net non-core funding dependence has decreased from the previous quarter down to 8.64. We consider that manageable for those particular institutions that are on the higher side. As I said at the last meeting, December is a peak time for the savings banks, and so now we're seeing the decline that we expected. The loan-to-deposit ratio is also elevated at 90.53%, but again, we know who those who are on the high end are and what they could do if they needed to. So we remain in close contact, not only through on-site exams, also through our off-site monitoring programs, and we tailor any directive action to that particular institution.
As those ratios get higher, is that a result of some strategic decision by the bank, or is it because of some unanticipated behavior?
It could be either. And that's something that we would look for. Is this something that is happening to them, or is this something that they're planning for? Under mergers and acquisitions on page 82, the Integrity Bank SSB sale occurred in that instance. They sold to a state commercial bank. On the other side of those type transactions, TBK Bank SSB has is planning to acquire three different banks out of state. And so the assets that will come in through the TBK purchases will basically replenish the assets that left the system with the Integrity sale. Our 11th annual Thrift Day is on September 13th. You should receive a save the date email shortly if you haven't already. We hope you can be there. It is a great way to hear our staff, who are subject matter experts in different areas, give information to the industry. It's also a great opportunity to see and meet some of our industry executive teams who are there. So we hope you can be there. With that, I'm going to move on to from the thrift industry to the non-bank residential mortgage lending industry, and starting with licensing, which is on page 82. I want to draw your attention to the chart, and I'm going to go back and do some more explanation of what this chart is. I've been asked some questions that I think would be helpful to answer to everybody. On the chart, entities, the MU1 is the license type for any type of entity, and each of those entities has to be licensed. On the branch, each of those branches has to be licensed, and those are the branches of the entities. And then MLO is the individual mortgage loan originator. Those are the people originating loans for the entities and the branches, and each of them has to be licensed. So the licensing population is right now right over 32,000, because it's the total of all three of those. The other thing I want to give you all some color to, again, because I've been asked it recently when we've had face-to-face meetings with the industry, whether it's talking to a local chapter of an association or at our own mortgage seminar day, we often find there's some misinformation in the industry about the licensing process. We hear the comment, well, it just takes a single click of a button, or it's a fully automated system. And so that's not accurate. And so I thought perhaps you all had some misunderstandings or some. So I thought I would explain to you all the same way that I explained to the industry. And I won't go through every single step, or we would be here way too long, but I will give you a high level view. So applications are submitted electronically, but there's still staff review and judgment required. For instance, for each of those, for applications from entities, branches, and individuals, the licensing staff has to confirm that all the information submitted is correct. They review disclosure questions, get explanations, and any information that supports what's been disclosed should we think that there may be an inaccuracy. And they review for prior administrative actions, either issued by SML or any other state in the country. So that's generally for all three. For individuals, additionally, these are some of the additional things they do. They verify that education and testing is correct and that it was properly taken and the tests were passed. They review criminal history to confirm whether there's any history that eliminates someone from obtaining a license in Texas. And they also review credit history for that same purpose. And so with regard to both criminal and credit, there's often multiple communications going back and forth as we request additional information so that we can make the right decision, and as staff seeks explanations and like I said, further documentation on what the criminal act was or what the credit issue was. I'll stop there and not go through other steps, but that gives you a general idea. So the end result of this licensing process, it determines two things that we are very conscious of and our licensing staff is very conscious of. One is they are making a determination that impacts someone's ability to be in the mortgage industry in Texas. And secondly, they're making a decision that impacts whether consumers are properly protected as they go through the process of obtaining a mortgage loan. So it does require knowledge, time for review, and human judgment. And definitely requires more than a single click, and it's not fully automated. So that's information that I've been asked recently from industry and, again, wanted to share with you all as well.
So you get an electronic submission. That's correct. About the automated part of it.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. Then I'll move on to examinations on page 82. The examination numbers are in the materials. I want to focus on two of the more frequent violations that we're seeing and tell you what we're doing to educate the industry. First is advertising and social media. This is also part of presentations that we give. We talk about what SML requires and give them best practices. We're in the process of putting those best practices on our website as well under the social examination part, so that people can go in and look and see what it is that that isn't required, but that we suggest. We always like to be able to give some practical, concrete tips that will help them be in compliance. And then it's also social media and advertising is also on the agenda for our own mortgage examiners at a training they're having next week, so that we make sure that they're as up to date as they need to be as well. And then the other frequent finding, I've mentioned in here before, it is the issues in incomplete or inaccurate use of conditional pre-qualification letters and conditional approval letters, otherwise known to all of us in our industry as Form A and Form B. We've been working on the industry on clarifying those letters, and under the legal report, you're going to hear some more detail on where we are in that process and what steps we've taken. We're planning to propose, as you saw in the rule schedule, we're planning to propose clarifying rules in August, so we want to give you a little more prep about where we are at this point in time.
Carolyn, can we go back to best practices?
Absolutely.
So how do you determine what a best practice is without going through a rulemaking proceeding to get public comment?
Right, and I actually prefer calling them tips or suggestions or recommendations, because they're not formalized best practices, but they're things that we have seen others in the industry do that are successful and helpful to them in handling their social media. For instance, we see folks who require that their employees' professional and personal social media platforms be separate, so that there's not that overlapping photo of the employee on their professional website doing something they prefer not to be on their professional. And we have seen companies who have someone who looks for social media, the companies on social media, to see what's out there that they don't know about. Because when we go in to examine and we look at social media, and there are some required things that I'll tell you as well if you would like, but we ask them for the list of where their social media platforms. And what we end up finding is the owner or the president of the company doesn't usually know all of what's out there. And so our examiner will just run the names and see what comes up and say, here's some more places where you're mentioned. So because we've seen that happen and seen them find things that the company would have liked to have known about, we put that down as here's a tip for you, is what we've seen someone else do. So that's really what we've accumulated. So, and the things that we examine for are, for instance, the NMLS number has to be on the website. Address, the physical.
No, I get that.
That sort of thing.
I was just trying. I couldn't get my head around.
Right.
What's a tip?
Right. It's things that we have.
Yes. A rule.
It's things that we have seen operate in other places that aren't a rule or a statute, but it's helpful for them to know.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. With regard to complaints, the first half of fiscal year 18, we had a 13% increase in complaints. The loan servicing complaints increased 8%, which, because they're usually always our largest percentage, isn't surprising. We do have tips, again, for servicers on our website, because, again, if we're seeing, because loan servicing complaints have been steadily at 60-61%, and now they've grown some, again, we like to give out some realistic, concrete tips that we see work in other places. And so we have those on our website in hopes of helping the servicing industry. And and we present those in face-to-face presentations as well. So that's complaints. I do want to say, even though they've increased, we certainly recognize that not all complaints are valid. often the customer does not give us sufficient information to make a determination, and some of the complaints we receive, as y'all know, aren't even under our jurisdiction. Other items, and kind of more operationally, we continue to train our examiners. As I said, the mortgage examiners have an internal training coming up next week, and the thrift examiners have internal training coming up early July. And in addition, they all do what I call external training as well. On page 84, we put a copy of a news article. There were many such news articles around this time. The Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection, I'm going to try to do this very simply because it dates back to October of 15, but for those of you who have been on the commission, you've heard me talk about TRID and Know Before You Owe. For those who have not been, the Bureau in October of 15 issued what was called Know Before You Owe mortgage rules. Basically, it changed a lot of things in the mortgage industry and established a loan estimate disclosure and a closing disclosure. And what that did, one of the unintended consequences, was a black hole where if the lender needed to reset their closing costs, they couldn't do it unless they did that 4 or more days prior to closing. And that caused some consternation in the industry, some real practical issues. So in April, the Bureau issued a final rule, and they removed that 4 business day prohibition, which one, I guess we'll find out as it's utilized, but one would think that will then close that black hole gap. And so because we do examine for Know Before You Owe compliance, what we have done as a result of the final rule is to review our own mortgage exam procedures and make any adjustments that we needed to make. On page 85, well, earlier this month we had our first turnover for fiscal year 18. It was a voluntary separation, and that was a transfer to another state agency. It was not a regulatory agency. I'm about to turn it over to legal. Do y'all have any other questions for me before I do that?
Talk about that picture.
Oh, the picture. Well, the state has the Get Fit Texas Challenge, and so staff can, and I did it too myself, but you track for, I don't remember if it was 6 weeks, or you track doing 150, you have to do 150 minutes of exercise a week, and you keep track of that, and then you all combine your total number of hours, and you're compared to other agencies in your category, and ours was 51 to 200, mm-hmm. And we got first place. So
oh my God.
We felt
very good. Antonio was saying it was 10 weeks, is it?
Six out of ten. Yes.
Madam Chairman, I think everybody in the room should now drop and give us 20. Except that Leslie can't do it.
She can't. So I guess we can't.
Well, I would like to know if OCCC and DOB participate.
I don't know.
We didn't participate this year. We've won it several years.
Oh.
We just wanted to do that.
So they just backed off. It's a great morale builder. Gave us something to be working on together. And one of our goals is to have a fit, healthy workforce. So
where's the trophy on display?
It's downstairs. It's big. I mean, it's like that.
It's big.
When we took the picture, I couldn't put it in front of me, or you wouldn't have been able to see me. I had to move it over here. But anyway, it's a fun thing to do, and keeps us all thinking about fitness and being healthy. So, one of the things we're proud of at SML is having several staff members who serve in the military. And one is our General Counsel, Ernest Garcia. He is on military leave this week. So our Associate General Counsel, Roberto Ramirez, is going to give you all the legal report. So, Roberto.
Good morning. Roberto Ramirez, Associate General Counsel. I'm going to start off with the legal activities on page 86. First to report is a contested case. This case was previously mentioned, but one update on this case is on May 31st of this year, the commissioner adopted the findings for the proposal for decision of the SOA judge, which upheld our license denial, and that was issued on the 31st. And also in second item is litigation. This litigation case was also mentioned previously. Just one update is that the defendants were served, and they were not, they did not answer. So we filed a motion for default judgment. By we, I mean the Attorney General's office. And currently we are awaiting a signed copy of that default judgment from the judge. Currently there is no gift reporting. And I briefly wanted to mention a speaking engagement that we participated in. Earlier this month, the department participated in the luncheon of the Austin Bankers Association. It was regarding the topic of mortgage fraud. Commissioner Jones spoke on cybersecurity. Our Director of Mortgage Examinations, Mr. Tony Florence, he spoke on specific exam findings, and I spoke on some recent mortgage fraud cases that would be of interest to the bankers there.
Yeah, and I'm going to just clarify for you, it was the Austin Mortgage Bankers Association.
Yes.
As you know. Yeah. Thank you.
Now for some of the SMO rule schedules, that is on page 87. As the commissioner already mentioned, at the August Finance Commission meeting, we anticipate making proposing rule actions in regards to our loan status forms. Those are found under Title VII of the Texas Admin Code 80.201 and 81.201. We plan on updating and providing some clarification on those forms. Now, in regards to those forms, we recently had a shareholders meeting where we received positive feedback, and we are currently receiving those, reviewing those comments that we received in that stakeholders meeting. And currently, that is all I have for the legal report. Do you have any questions for me?
Thanks, Roberta.
Thank you very much.
And unless there are further questions, that would conclude our report for savings and mortgage lending.
Okay, thank you. Okay, it is 9:55 on June 15, 2018. At this time, the commission will go into closed session pursuant to government code section 551.071. At this time, the commission requests that all non-commission members leave the room with the exception of any agency staff necessary to discuss the issue. It is estimated will be an executive session for 20 minutes. Yes. Okay. It is 10:23 on June 15, 2018, and the commission is now back in open session. No action was taken in closed session. Members, any further business? There being no further business, this
Stacey,
meeting.
I'm sorry. Yeah, just our next meeting is August 17th. I very well may be replaced by August 17th. I just wanted to tell everyone. Thank you very much.
With respect to the new member, thank you for mentioning that, so I can comment
time.
On
yes.
that. With respect to the update on new members, I have been informed that in time for the August meeting, we will be advised as to what the new members will be. I don't have any news as to if anybody's being reappointed or not reappointed or who the new members are yet. That announcement is supposed to be made sometime in July.
But it has been a pleasure and a heck of an experience. Thank
and
you.
And I hope we aren't seeing you for the last time.
Yes. Yeah, and then we have sunset right after that, right on the 20th.
Yes.
After our next meeting.
Aren't we having fun?
So
I think you should be burdened by another reappointment. So I don't think you should get off.
Are you saying you're not returning or that you may not be returning?
May not.
He doesn't know.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
I believe there's three of us.
Yes, there are three.
Jay, myself, and you.
And we do know that Jay will not be returning. Right. What we don't know is the other two member seats. The other thing I do want to mention is in planning for the August new members being added to the commission, we will be doing a new member orientation, of course, to bring in the new members. And if anybody feels like the new member orientation would be of assistance to them, I would encourage you to plan to attend that as well, because that would be an ideal opportunity, especially for newer members, to be reacquainted with everything and become more familiar with what we're doing. And with that, being no further business, this meeting of the Finance Commission is now adjourned, and the time is 10:25, which that may be a record.